You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of January 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Matt Alagaya. On today's show... Violent unrest continues in Tunisia as demonstrators protest against rising prices and tax hikes. My guests Mary Dajewski and Michael Binion will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the often strained relationship between Canada and the US in the era of Trump, the worst possible first week in the job for the US ambassador to the Netherlands, and why the Russian embassy in Washington is not loving its new address. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Matt Alagaya. Welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Mary Dajewski, columnist for The Independent and The Guardian, and Michael Binion, foreign affairs specialist for The Times. Welcome both of you to the programme. Let's start in Tunisia. Protesters across the country have taken to the streets for a third successive night in opposition to the government's austerity measures. The country's police force has used tear gas against large crowds, while the Tunisian Prime Minister, Youssef Chahed, has said that the protests are an attempt to weaken the state. Michael, let me start with you. Who are the demonstrators in Tunisia in the main, and what do they want?
Overwhelmingly, they're young people. They're people who are unemployed. Quite a lot of them are well-educated. They're graduate unemployment casualties. They've got an education. They can't find a job. There are a lot of small shopkeepers as well who are finding living conditions tough. And they're just ordinary people angered by the recent rise in both taxes and in food prices.
And what is the state of the economy in Tunisia? I mean, why are food prices going up? Why are tax hikes needed?
Well, it's not doing very well. I mean, it's suffering as many places in the region are, from too much government spending, from subsidies that are no longer sustainable, and from the demands by international financiers, including international bodies, for them to cut subsidies, to make prices more realistic, to cut back on spending and to balance their budget, which they need to do because they desperately need an injection of much needed money. And those are the conditions.
Is it a bit one of those moments where you think that maybe international debtors could be a bit friendlier and maybe leave them a bit longer to pay this back?
One always thinks that. Yes, I suppose so. But it's very hard because if you're making an exception there, then you have to make an exception for almost everywhere, because each country will say we're a special hardship case. And there are some international lenders who on principle never, never allow debt forgiveness. And I'm thinking especially of Japan.
I see. Mary, human rights campaigners have been quick to call the government's response disproportionate and gratuitously violent. Is there evidence of that?
Well, I think there's what seems to me to be an enormous number of people have been arrested. I think upwards of 600 over the last 3 days, 300 last night alone, which sounds like an awful lot of people actually to have in custody and to control and to be in charge of, quite apart from anything else. And then you think of all the ramifications, you know, all the people they were with, all the people they knew, all the families. You know, you're talking about really quite a risky operation here in its scale. But I think sort of one of the things that probably strikes both of us is that, you know, this is Tunisia. This is where it all began. 2011, Arab Spring, as we now say, you know, dreadfully misnamed, but the sort of the shadows of that keep coming back. And you think, if Tunisia, which was hailed as at least partially the most successful of all the sort of Arab Spring countries, where there were revolts that mostly failed, and you look at Tunisia, and if that is now going to fail, then, you know, you're looking at a very bleak picture right across the region.
I mean, is there a sense that potentially that view of Tunisia is a bit flawed, though? I mean, we have always considered it the exception to the rule of the Arab Spring. But I mean, do you think actually that that sort of papered over the cracks a little bit?
Well, I think it did. I was actually in Tunisia about 3 years ago, and it struck me that, you know, it gave an impression of being really quite a depressed country. And when you go to Egypt or Tunisia or Algeria, any of those countries, I mean, the demographic just stares you in the face that there are so many young men of an age between sort of 18 and 30 just standing around with nothing to do. And some of them at least feel hugely resentful that they've educated themselves or been educated by the state and there is nothing for them to do.
And Michael, what do you think the government is afraid of? I mean, we heard that they've put a lot of people in jail for this. Why clamp down, I guess, in such a way?
Well, because any demonstration that is basically fueled by want or need or poverty or human resentment at the lack of human dignity, all those turn political. And almost always there is the danger that the target will be the government and they'll take to the streets and there would be an attempt at another revolution. And the government just feels it cannot afford that. It doesn't have easy answers. It would like to push out some subsidies or something to get the people off the street, but they can't take the risk of having 600 or so activists on the street inciting others, and so they're going to arrest them. And they are pretty jumpy. After all, they came fairly close to having the whole Arab Spring overturned in their country as well when the Islamists were accused of incitement and of murder, murdering a liberal politician 3 or 4 years ago. And that nearly went wrong again.
And is the government now insecure? I mean, do you think it is weak and actually this is partly, this reaction has been partly because they're worried that they could be overthrown?
Yes, it is fairly weak. It's based on assent. It is a democratically elected government. In fact, 4 Tunisians recently won the Nobel Prize for their work in formulating a working constitution. And they do treasure that, but it's not based on a kind of strength of enforcement. And unless you've got a police force that's utterly impartial and widely respected and has the resources to deal with demonstrations, there is always the worry that this thing will get out of hand.
And Mary, we should be clear, I guess, that this is, you know, we're not talking about entirely peaceful demonstrations either. I mean, there have been, you know, I mean, it is unrest. It's protesters throwing Molotov cocktails and looting as well. What effect do you think that's having on the dynamic there, I guess?
Well, I think one of the things that when you look at the map of where the disturbances and the riots have been taking place, it is very far spread across Tunisia. And there is this huge disparity between towns and country, which can be really inflammatory, and I think you're looking at some of that. But also the extent of, you know, it has to be said, you know, stone throwing Molotov cocktails, those sort of things, they, as it were, invite the sort of repressions that are currently in progress, and they invite the language that's been coming from the Prime Minister, which is talking about sedition and all sorts of, you know, totally unacceptable, but presenting people as destabilizing the government. And all that is, I mean, it's just a dreadfully dangerous destabilizing mixture.
Of course, I just want to add as a postscript, one of the things that they're particularly afraid of is that Tunisia had the highest proportion of any young Arab groups joining ISIS, joining the Islamic State. And that was partly reflecting exactly this same sort of discontent. Over-educated, or not over-educated, but educated people with no jobs, feeling that they were undervalued and went off to fight in ISIS. And now, of course, ISIS has been defeated on the battleground. So many of these people are sneaking back in again. And I think that is a big worry for the authorities.
And as we come to the end of the third day of protests, what is the likelihood, do you think, of the government offering some concessions? I mean, could they suspend some tax rises, perhaps, and restore order? Or do you think the genie is kind of out of the bottle now, Mary?
Well, you sort of hope that they would do, because that's really the only avenue they can go down. Because at the moment, it looks, it simply looks as though the tensions are rising and things are going to get worse on either side. But the problem is, of course, as Michael said, that the pressure is coming from the banks and the lenders and everybody who's saying, well, you can't do that because the money is going to stop or run out. So I think it's the classic dilemma, and it really doesn't look very good.
Michael, what do you expect finally in the coming days? I mean, do you think the demonstrations will continue to intensify tomorrow and over the weekend. And I guess if they do, what are then the ramifications more broadly?
Well, I think they may pull back from the real brink, because Tunisians have been here before, almost to the brink, even since the Arab Spring. And they've looked at their very dangerous neighbourhood around them. And many of them think, we don't want to end up like Libya, which, of course, is a very destabilising influence on their southern border. And they don't really like what's going on in Algeria either. They are in a fairly precarious area, and I think many of them will feel if this thing becomes so destabilised that the government either abolishes democracy, abolishes parliament, has a military government set up, we have lost everything. So there may be some attempt to pull back. If the government can find a way of some sort of compromise and opening some kind of line of communication to the main youth leaders, whoever they are, then they may get away with it.
But to be clear, the government, the ball's kind of in the government's court, really.
It is, really, yes.
OK, let's continue now with a look at the strained relations between the US and Canada. The latter filed a 32-page complaint to the World Trade Organization yesterday, accusing the US of breaking international trade rules. So is this the opening salvo in an escalating trade war? Well, Mary, first of all, what is Canada actually alleging in its complaint to the WTO? And what behaviour of the US is it taking issue with?
Well, Canada is really complaining that a lot of the arbitration procedures and the judgments and the way the Americans pursue what they and how they define unfair trade is discriminating against an awful lot of what Canada exports to the US. And one of the problems is always that with almost everybody, which is that the United States almost decrees a sort of global governance that US law should pertain everywhere. And one of the particular complaints of the Canadians is that they say, well, if the arbitrators are split 50-50, then the argument goes America's way. So there are quite specific things they're complaining about, and discrimination against US-produced timber is one, and newsprint related to that. Those are specifics. There's also an argument about plane manufacturers of Bombardier. So all these things are on the horizon. But I think in some ways it's quite, you can hardly say entertaining, but it's sort of fascinating to watch Canada, which has so much smaller an economy, taking on the might of the United States through international institution of the WTO. And they're trying to take it back, interestingly. It's not primarily an anti-Trump manoeuvre. They're taking it back way beyond sort of 10 years past. So it's obviously the grievances go back a long way. But you also think, well, maybe there's a much closer pretext, which is that in talking about rewriting the NAFTA agreement, that maybe that actually isn't going all that well from Canada's point of view. And so they're looking at that and getting their oar in first.
I will come to NAFTA in a second. But Michael, first of all, how has Canada dealt so far with the Trump administration? I mean, I feel like I was quite surprised by this because I thought Canada had been quite careful in its dealings with Trump up until now. This is really quite a bold move, isn't it?
Yes, it is, but it's a long-burning, a long-simmering one. And as Mary's absolutely right, this resentment at US behaviour goes back a long, long way. And I would say it's not confined to Canada. Canada has quite worldwide support for its actions. Britain, I mean, has usually exemplary relations with the US, except over trade. And the British deeply resent what they see as high-handedness by American trade officials and discrimination. And this is a recurring theme in the way America deals with even its closest allies. They walk all over what are regarded as neutral agreements to protest or protect what they think are their own advantages. And therefore, the Canadians, they've simply had enough of that. It is, to some extent, firing a shot at Mr. Trump, but I think much more it's just expressing a general annoyance that they feel they're being bullied, that their big neighbour to the south is trampling all over them.
And Robert Lighthizer, the US trade representative, called it a broad and ill-advised attack on the US trade remedies system. I mean, could this lead to a real deterioration in relations between Washington and Ottawa, Michael?
It could. It depends whether the Canadians choose to make it political and make it relevant, particularly to this administration and this president. There would be plenty of support in Canada to do that. I mean, Trump is probably even more unpopular north of the border than he is within the US. And I think a lot of people feel that he is just leading an administration that is blinkered and is actually going to harm normal good relations between the US and Canada. So if it's going to go wrong anyway, why not attack now?
And while denying its claims, Lighthizer did say that Canada's complaint would be bad for Canada and that other countries would benefit more than Canada. He has a point, doesn't he, Mary? I mean, Canada does kind of depend on trade with the US.
Well, it does, but also Canada is quite, I would say, psychologically self-sufficient in a way that maybe often isn't appreciated. And when you were talking about the way that Canada has sort of dealt with Trump and saying that it handled it quite carefully, I mean, that's true on the one hand. But on the other hand, the way that Justin Trudeau personally has handled Trump has been very much on an insistence of sort of equal status and equal imagery. And I think that's played very well back in Canada. So, I mean, even if there were to be a marginal bit of deprivation because of maybe American retaliation, I think the Canadians would hang on in there and take it.
And in the background, we mentioned, obviously, earlier, we have the ongoing renegotiation of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. Michael, it looks increasingly like Trump is going to pull out of the agreement. Does this Canada complaint, do you think it increases the likelihood of him pulling out?
It could do, yes. I think he'll do it anyway. I think there'll be a rather messy end to this agreement. It's just as much aimed at pulling out of Mexico or pulling out of the agreement with Mexico. I think for Trump that's more important because he complains endlessly that Mexicans are stealing American jobs because they, of course, work for lower wages. And that's where American industry is looking to put its cheap manufacturing plants. And that, he feels, is exporting US jobs. So that's what he's concerned about. I don't think he particularly worries about the implications of the free trade agreement with Canada because it goes, apart from what we've just been talking about, it goes quite well for the American point of view. Any international agreement, if you pull it apart, you get repercussions, as of course Theresa May's government is finding in Britain.
And if you, if the US did pull out of NAFTA, I guess there's an interesting thing because NAFTA continues to exist between Canada and Mexico. And also Mexico is still talking about TPP without America. Could we see America just being completely isolated when it comes to trade?
We could, but then American trade is so enormous and so overwhelming that I think other countries wouldn't want to leave America out of the entire equation. They're still going to trade with the US, whatever the terms. It's impossible, really, for the Americans simply to shut themselves off.
And Mary, what happens now? I guess we've seen Canada launch this complaint. Does the WTO now investigate this? And when, I guess, can we expect a response? I mean, these things take many, many
years.
Well,
I was going to say, these are the sort of things that trundle on for a very, very long time. So we're probably not going to see any particular result very soon. But of course, the fact that they trundle along means that relations can be poisoned to a degree the whole time that that's happening. I think also I'd just like to add something about whether the US would be isolated, because I think in a lot of the things that Trump has said and even the things that he's done, they don't really happen. He makes the statements, you know, whether it's on recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, whether it's on pulling out of the Pacific Trade Agreement, whether it's pulling out of the Paris Climate Change Agreement. He makes all those statements. But actually, it often turns out, at least so far, that it doesn't really depend very much on him. There's all sorts of other things that can happen. There's the action of individual US states on the one hand. There's also the fact that often these things seem just to sort of lie there. And the big move, if you like, is the gesture, which probably pleases his constituency in the US. But I think around the world, people are starting to learn that they don't need to react quite as aggressively in response to what look like major steps taken by Trump, because actually they may not happen.
A very shrewd and important point.
Exactly. And Michael, finally, I mean, I just want to get an impression from you on what this means for brand Canada. I mean, we see Canada being hailed as the great liberal state now. Do you think something like this reinforces that impression that people have?
Well, it makes Canada seem a little less bland than it often does to people overseas, who always accuse Canada of being very, very good, very well-intentioned, and hence very dull. Well, it's not really particularly any of those, but it certainly is well-intentioned, but it's not necessarily dull. It's quite feisty at times, and they want to show that they are feisty. And to some extent, this will rally Canadian nationalism or Canadian national feeling, which can always do with a little bit of encouragement.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Matt Alagaya, and I'm joined here by Mary Dajewski and Michael Binion. Now, Donald Trump's ambassador to the Netherlands is having a rough first week in the job. Peter Hoekstra held his first press conference with the Dutch media yesterday, and he was grilled over claims he made in 2015 that there are no-go areas in the country where, and I quote, there are cars being burned and politicians being burned. Here's what happened.
Would you please take back the remark about burned politicians? Or name the politician that was burned in the Netherlands.
Thank you.
Why don't you answer the question? Answer the question. This is not how this works, guys. Come on.
This is the Netherlands. You have to answer questions.
This is the Netherlands. You should answer questions. Mary, should we be seeing more of this approach from journalists at press conferences? I mean, it was quite refreshing to see the Dutch press united in this attack on what was clearly a bit of fake news.
Well, I think in some ways we are starting to see, or seeing again, a more, how should I say, a more sort of united front and more firmness on the part of press corps. Certainly, you know, if you think about the Washington press corps, which used to be really supine, now you look at it confronting Trump, and you've got, or at least his spokespeople, and you've got much more of a sort of to and fro than you used to have. More, you could say, of the sort of thing that you've had almost forever, at least in my memory, in Britain. I mean, you know, the British press corps and the lobby can be very aggressive and single-minded towards prime minister or spokesman or individual ministers. So I think maybe it's that sort of attitude that that could be spreading.
And Michael, I mean, it's actually interesting that Mary mentioned that, because we don't see Trump in that situation very often, do we? I mean, in the US, journalists don't often have access to Trump in the same way. He has his spokespeople out there a lot of the time. It's quite difficult to get around that, isn't it?
Very difficult. I mean, in the US, there is no obligation for the president ever to speak to the press. And some presidents have used their press conferences quite effectively as a way of communicating with the general public. And you think of others who came in for a certain amount of bullying and taunting, but were still willing to go out there. President Reagan, for one, who used his press conferences very effectively, even though it was quite easy to catch him out on some things. But I think the particular aggression in some journalists now, well, robustness, should I say,
yes,
is because, yes, what has given it an edge is because they have been accused of fake news, the main media. And they're saying, well, here's a prime example of fake news. This is the person who said that politicians are being burned. Is it true? Give us the example. If it's not, it's fake news, and you're the one accusing us of fake news.
It did feel like the Dutch media finally getting its chance to attack the Trump administration, which, yes, you feel like they probably aren't in agreement on a lot of things.
Well, I was sort of surprised that the US ambassador decided to put himself in front of the press corps. I mean, I don't think there's any obligation on foreign ambassadors to put themselves out for the benefit of the local press, and I couldn't quite understand why he'd put danger so much in his way.
Well, he kind of tried. Yeah. It was interesting. He tried to get ahead of the story a little bit and say before at the end of his speech, you know, I've made some comments in the past and I'd like to move on now. And the journalists were having absolutely none of it, basically.
Well, it's foolish because one of the prime rules for all diplomacy is that a diplomat is a man who thinks twice before he says nothing.
You're totally the wrong way around.
And both of you have worked in Moscow. You've done the Moscow correspondent job. I'm interested to hear from you. What were press conferences like at the Kremlin? I mean, presumably you weren't given quite as much free rein as the Dutch journalists were given yesterday.
Well, at least in my time when I was there as a full-time correspondent, which was through the end of communism, they tried to keep the foreign press corralled in the foreign ministry, and so we were given the benefit of the foreign minister and the foreign minister's spokesman, Gennady Gerasimov, who was a tremendous character and liked sort of winding the press around his little finger. But something really interesting happened through those the sort of late years of Glasnost as the Soviet Union was collapsing, which was that Soviet Russian correspondents started to be admitted to those press conferences with the International Press Corps. Until then, we'd been kept separate. And what then happened was that the Soviet correspondents started adopting the same techniques as the Western correspondents. And so I vividly remember a press conference and a Q&A with the spokesman, and it was something about Jewish emigration and not allowing people to go to Israel. And the spokesman came back absolutely immediately and said, "I wouldn't have expected that sort of question from one of our correspondents."
Wow. And Michael, any?
Well, I was there in the dozy days of Brezhnev. I mean, when there was a press conference, was completely unheard of. I mean, Brezhnev himself never appeared before the foreign press. Occasionally, you were allowed into the Kremlin to see him greet a politician from your country if he happened to be there, but that was in itself a revelation. And the only people who would brief the Western press in those days were occasional people with good access to party headquarters who were themselves journalists but were sent out there to try to give the West something to say, but no official press conferences.
Right. And finally today, Washington, D.C. has just renamed the street where the Russian embassy is situated, and it's been named after a murdered Russian opposition politician and activist. Washington City Council voted to rename the street after Boris Nemtsov, who was shot outside the Kremlin in 2015. The officials say the decision honours the slain democracy activist, but Russian politicians have criticised the move and called it a dirty trick. Michael, was this a sensible decision, do you think, or needlessly confrontational?
Well, it's a bit bizarre because they've done exactly the same thing only 15 or 20 years ago when the square outside the Russian embassy, the embassy's always been where it is, on 16th Street. They've named the square Andrei Sakharov Plaza as a way of trying to provoke the then Soviet Union because it was persecuting Andrei Sakharov, the dissident scientist. Well, he's now, of course, an honoured figure in Russia, so they've now named him after
and
another
has his
dissident.
Own street named in Moscow after him.
Okay.
So naming streets to try to tweak other governments' noses is not always a particularly clever idea. You can name all kinds of streets. I mean, the Spanish are having a bit of a problem now because they've got a Margaret Thatcher Plaza, and they're wondering whether actually they really want this any longer and whether it's appropriate or whether they shouldn't. I mean, you shouldn't rush into naming streets after local people who seem to be a good thing at the time.
Mary, what are your thoughts? I mean, do you think this is, I guess, confrontational, provocative?
I mean, it's deliberately confrontational and provocative, and it's only quite a small stretch of the street that they're naming after Boris Nemtsov. And I don't have any particular problem with it. I think it's a gesture which, everybody knows the extent of that. And I don't know how long it'll last. It may last for a long time. But if we go back to the fact that there's now a Sakharov Boulevard in Moscow. I think maybe if you look ahead 20 years, you may get a Boris Nemtsov Street in Moscow too. So, maybe it's a sign of the future rather than just a provocation.
I think they have to be careful not to overreact. I mean, these things happen. They've just had the same case in Turkey where the Turks have got very angry about the United Arab Emirates accusing some Ottoman general of being an oppressor of the Arabs when he was down in Medina, I think it was, and linking this person with the parents, or not the parents, but the ancestors of the present president, Erdogan, who of course saw that as a deliberate insult and has immediately named the street in Ankara, where the UAE embassy is, after this general. But if you allow yourself to be provoked, then of course you've lost the game. The British had the same thing happen to them in Tehran, where in 1981, at the height of the IRA hunger strikers, when Mrs. Thatcher refused to give in, one of them, who claimed to be a political prisoner, went on to starve himself to death, and in fact died, Bobby Sands. And so the Iranians, in a rage with Britain, as they often were, named the street Bobby Sands Street. Well, the British then found a separate entrance that led off to the other direction, so they led off to a Persian-named street, and nobody could complain then.
Interesting. And I just want to, I mean, quickly, a brief thought from both of you. I mean, what do you think this is hoping to achieve? I mean, you mentioned there that you've lost the game if you get provoked. Is it just trying to rile
yes,
the Russians?
I mean, it's scoring political points. And I think if I was sitting in Moscow and advising them what to do, I would pick some, you know, small section of some part of the ring road outside the American embassy and name it something symbolic. In fact, the best way maybe of provoking Donald Trump would be to call it Obama Plaza.
Exactly.
Yes. I mean, you mustn't be provoked. Oh, many people don't even realise they're living on these streets. I had an apartment in Cyprus for a long time, and it was on a street that I realised after about 5 years was named after a person that the British forces actually hanged in Cyprus.
Wow. Thanks very much. I'm afraid that brings us to the end of today's show. Thank you very much to Mary Dzhevsky and Michael Binion. Thanks for joining us here at Midori House. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Katy Mendoza, and our studio manager was Christy Evans. More music next, then at 1900 hours, it's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. We'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 London time. I'm Matt Alagaya. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.